The Fed wants banks to hold on to more money in case of trouble.
Is that really a good idea in a weak economy?
From APM, American Public Media in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. It's Friday, June 8th.
Coming up, why are companies still hoarding so much cash?
How much should you trust the sell-by dates on the food you buy?
And a lesson from Massachusetts. You're nothing special.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
America's top bank regulator, the Federal Reserve, has just approved a plan to make every bank in America keep more money at the ready to give the banking system a better shot at weathering the next financial storm. It's part of an international effort known as Basel III that's been resisted by many large banks. What's come as a bit of a surprise is that the Fed wants the rules to apply to small banks as well as the biggies, as Marketplace's David Gura reports from Washington.
The Fed's rule would require banks to hold more cash relative to their total assets. That'd be a cushion of capital. Simon Johnson is an economist at MIT.
So the idea is to have bigger buffers against losses and to make it harder for important financial institutions to fail, bringing down the world's financial system.
Banks say holding cash as a buffer would make it harder for them to lend, but supporters of this new rule argue the money would come from other places. Kenneth Rogoff teaches economics at Harvard. He says that if a bank is getting all its money by borrowing, it's more likely to collapse when there's a financial crisis because it'll have trouble paying back its loans.
If on the other hand, a lot of its money comes from issuing stock, well, the shareholders bear the loss, and that's no fun, but it's automatic, and the taxpayer doesn't have to step in.
Over the next 3 months, the Fed will accept comment letters critiquing the proposal. It's likely many of them will be angry ones from lobbyists for the banking industry who say higher capital requirements and raising money through stocks would be too costly. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Well, the Fed wants banks to hold on to more cash, but would rather companies start spending the cash they're holding on to. And according to Ernst & Young, about 2,000 of the largest companies in the U.S. and Europe are still sitting on more than $1 trillion. Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell joins us now to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, what are these companies waiting for, Chris? Why are they hoarding all this cash still?
Well, the same reason why you and I and, you know, lots of our listeners are trying to hoard cash. There's all this uncertainty, and cash is the best hedge against uncertainty. You don't know, are we going to fall back into recession? Are we going to have another global economic crisis? Will the U.S. march off the proverbial fiscal cliff come 2013? Companies getting a little bit nervous, might as well hold on to that cash.
But we've been hearing about uncertainty now for 4 years since the financial crisis. You'd think at some point uncertainty sort of becomes certainty of uncertainty and people start to do things again.
Well, you're absolutely right. And American Express did a survey back in February of CFOs, global CFOs, and asked them lots of questions about their cash. You know, and back then, they kind of captured the sense of a moderate economic recovery. And 45% of the CFOs says, you know, they had plans to spend down their cash. That compares to 62% the previous year, same survey, said they had a cash preservation strategy. So I think you're right. But right now, there's almost a irrational panic, Jeremy, about the Eurozone and what's going to happen with the Eurozone. So I think everyone's sort of, you know, pulling back a little bit and, you know, maybe we do want to spend some of this money, but just not yet.
Okay. Well, when they do decide to go out and spend this money, these companies, what's going to be the impact on the economy?
Look, the impact is going to be good for the economy. I think it will essentially support the story of a moderate economic recovery, not a rousing recovery, but a moderate economic recovery. So what the CFO said they're going to spend the money on is research and development, software, information technology, things to make their companies more efficient, and hiring. So, you know, taken all together, it would be good news if we get past this period of uncertainty.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
In Oklahoma City today, the country's second largest natural gas company will face some angry shareholders. And it's not just because its stock is down 20% for the year. Chesapeake Energy has other problems, including reports of questionable CEO behavior. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Earlier this spring, news reports suggested that CEO Aubrey McClendon mixed personal business with the companies. Chesapeake Energy stock tanked and shareholders screamed. The firm stripped McClendon of his board chairmanship. And as for him personally borrowing from company lenders, that ended too. Not enough, says Michael Garland. He represents New York City pension funds, a Chesapeake investor.
They saw that in recent weeks, the incremental steps that they took were not restoring confidence among investors, and I think ultimately they had no choice.
No choice but to give activist shareholders 4 board seats Monday. A new chairperson will give outsiders a majority 5. But fixing the board doesn't fix everything, says Philip Weiss at Argus Research. The company balance sheet is red all over.
And it has a significant amount of balance sheet debt, as well as off-balance sheet debt. And that while natural gas prices are up, they're still not at numbers high enough to make natural gas production economic.
There are rumors that Chesapeake Energy, or big pieces of it, are on the sales block. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And we did learn this morning that Chesapeake is going to sell its pipeline and related assets in some transactions totaling about $4 billion.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
One of the big rain clouds hanging over the markets this morning is coming from the plains of Spain. Well, maybe the cities. There are reports that the Spanish government could ask Europe to bail out its banks this weekend. Chris Lowe is chief economist with FTN Financial. He joins us from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Chris, Spain is obviously a much bigger economy than Greece, which is having troubles of its own. Are things getting out of control in Spain, do you think?
I think actually they're getting a little bit more in control. In the markets, we've been aware that Spain needs a bank bailout for a while, partly because their finance minister pretty much let the cat out of the bag on Wednesday. But up until now, the conditions the Germans mostly were demanding were too stringent. It now looks like those conditions are relaxing, and that's what's allowed them to ask formally for help.
Well, let me ask you about the banks here in this country, because something just happened yesterday from the Federal Reserve. It has now decided it's going to require all banks, even small ones in this country, to hold more cash on hand in case of trouble. Do you think that's a good idea with a weak economy?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to address. The reason the Fed did this, it's part of an effort with international regulators. They're tightening up rules so we don't have a repeat of what happened in 2008 and 2009. But it is going to be restrictive for the economy because banks are not going to be able to lend as much in proportion to the amount of capital they hold.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks as always.
You're welcome. Thank you.
If you think about it, a bailout in Spain tomorrow would remove some uncertainty before the Greek general election later this month. If that election forces Greece to stop using the euro, rolling out a replacement currency, the drachma, will be complicated. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
When Greece adopted the euro, its old currency, the drachma, was collected and destroyed. Plus, the machine that printed those notes is outdated. It now sits in a museum. Getting a new modern currency designed and printed would take weeks, if not months.
So we're going back to the very basic, simple idea of exchange. You give me milk, I give you water.
Marios Eftimiopoulos is president of Strategy International, a research firm based in Greece. While waiting for a new currency, he says the country would need a temporary substitute.
We will be working with coupons.
Also, everything sold now in euros would need a new price tag.
You would need to basically put new prices on everything and into every computer system. And this, again, would be something that would take some weeks.
Jacob Kierkegaard is a research fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says the shift would cause hyperinflation.
The cost would be catastrophic. Greek living standards would fall by a third, maybe half.
He says many of the country's trading partners would likely refuse to be paid in the new currency, making a new drachma effectively worthless outside of Greece. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
More now following the theft of 6.5 million passwords from the business contact networking site LinkedIn. along with hacks at the dating site eHarmony and the music site Last.fm. Computer security experts say it's time to rethink passwords, as Christopher Wirth reports.
You know those security questions you get asked in case you forget your password?
Where did you go to high school, and where did you meet your husband?
What is your mother's maiden name? Graham Cluley of the online security company Sophos says, yes, security questions make your account more secure, but some questions are just too easy to find the answers to if someone really wants them. In those cases, he says, the best thing to do is lie.
What I do is I will write something like Xena Warrior Princess. It's not as though Gmail and Yahoo are going to check what your mother's maiden name is.
As password hacking becomes more common, Cluley says online companies are beginning to make it a little harder. For example, Apple now requires iTunes users to answer a series of questions instead of just one. But Ant Allen of Gartner Research says in the age of Facebook, where we share everything online, companies have to find more obscure questions that no one can find the answers to.
A good sample question would be something like, what was the name of your favorite stuffed animal you had as a child?
Problem is, he says, once he's told you what a good security question is, the less secure it becomes. I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Here in the U.S., NBC will be the place to watch the Olympics this summer. But in countries around the world where broadcast rights haven't been sold, people can turn to YouTube. The International Olympic Committee is going to live stream the games to 64 Asian and African countries. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The free YouTube stream won't be dominated by coverage of swimming and gymnastics like U.S. coverage is, because people in, say, Angola, Pakistan, and Nepal are more interested in
ping pong or weightlifting or taekwondo. Those are sports that U.S. and some of the Western countries are not winning all the golds.
That's sports marketer Ben Sterner of the Leverage Agency. He likes the live stream idea, but wonders if it's feasible. Tech analyst Larry Weber heads the W2 Group. He says there are a number of problems.
First one is bandwidth. Hello, you know, most of these countries don't even have bandwidth enough for voice conversations.
And only about 20% of the population in developing countries is online, according to the UN. Still, if the feed attracts enough interest, the Olympic Committee may be able to persuade a broadcaster to buy the TV rights for future Olympics. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Something fishy is going on across the pond. Private companies in the UK are going to power some of their stores with leftover food. Maybe some old fish, seriously. In today's Midday Extra, the BBC's Romy Levine reports from London.
Here in the United Kingdom, retail giants like Walmart and the grocery store chain Tesco are taking food waste and they're converting that into electricity. Food waste biodegrades quickly, and that can produce more biogas to generate power. So the stores are trying out energy from fish heads, chicken fat, old lamb chops, even unwanted sandwiches. Yes, it's green, but the companies are also doing it to save money. There's a new landfill tax in the UK, a hefty fee for companies that send their waste to a public dump. And by burning their garbage and turning it into electricity, Walmart and others can avoid that tax. Catelyn Shepherd, co-founder of the food waste advocacy group This Is Rubbish, says moves towards sustainability are commendable, but she questions the humanitarian intentions.
I find it quite hard to believe that large corporations will simply be focusing on the environmental and social responsibilities.
Bloomberg New Energy Finance says $18.2 billion have been invested globally in waste-to-energy initiatives in the past 5 years. In London, I'm the BBC's Romy Levine from Marketplace.
And watch how we keep this theme going here. The other day, we were cleaning out the fridge here at Marketplace, the New York Bureau, Jeremy. Once a decade, whether it needs it or not, you've seen the fridge.
Yes.
Well, during this hazmat procedure, it was duly noted that the oldest legible sell-by date found was September 2009.
Whoa.
Yeah, uh-huh. Marketplace's Adrian Hill is working on a story about food safety for our weekend show, Marketplace Money. I figured, why not ask her how carefully these sell-by dates are regulated? Adrian, good morning.
Good morning, David.
So help me understand. Expiration dates, it's clear. If it says a certain date and it's past it, don't eat it.
Not quite. Unfortunately, it's really complicated. The thing to know is the federal government only requires expiration dates. The only food date it requires is on infant formula. So the rest of the dates you see, use by, sell by, best by, eat by, all of those things, they're regulated at the state level, and they're often established by the food companies.
All right. Do any of those, that long list, do they mean anything?
Well, it kind of depends on the date. Here's Christine Bruhn. She's a food science professor at UC Davis.
It varies depending upon the food product. Sometimes it tells you when the grocery store should be selling the product. Sometimes it tells you the quality of the product and when you should be using it.
So a lot of this is just about common sense about what to eat and what to toss.
So how do you decide? I mean, eat it and maybe preserve some food or spend the money and start all over?
Well, it kind of depends on the food. There are some foods like eggs, which I always wonder about, that are good after the sell-by date that you see on the package. And the USDA says you can actually eat them 3 to 5 weeks after you buy them, even if that sell-by date has passed.
If you crack them open and a chicken comes out, it's too late.
It's too late. Do not eat that. And with dairy, which is something else I wonder about, here's Bruhn again.
If it's something like dairy products, milk and yogurt, these have been pasteurized. They can safely be consumed beyond that sell-by date.
I mean, Adrian, many of us just use the nose test, right?
Yeah. You know, this is actually how I eat, too. I sniff around. I look around. And I talked to some food scientists. They told me there are bacteria that are dangerous out there that actually can grow in your foods and you can't smell them.
So, all right, any reporting the story, did you glean any secret tips for wasting less food and maybe less money?
The best piece of advice, just buy less and there'll be less to spoil.
All right. Marketplace's Adrian Hill. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And finally to Massachusetts, where graduating seniors at Wellesley High School got some tough advice from their English teacher, David McCullough Jr. Yes, as in David McCullough's son. He said, "You're not special. Contrary to what your soccer trophy suggests or your glowing seventh grade report card or your batty Aunt Sylvia, you're nothing special. Even if you're one in a million," he continued, "on a planet of 6.8 billion, that means there are nearly 7,000 people just like you." He then urged the students to work hard and do what they love, David.
This guy's no Mr. Rogers, is he?
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Midday Update on APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.